Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. I'm Alex, and with me, as usual, is James. Be sure to check out our website, themacguffinmen.com. We most recently talked about the Man with No Name trilogy, and before that, we did a video podcast on Brick earlier this week. I wrote a thing about Vince Staples, True Detective, and hip-hop history and whatnot. So, those things all link together somehow. Anyway, check us out at themacguffinmen.com. Also follow us on Twitter, at themacguffinmen. We'll just get right to the theme song.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. And now, here are Alex and James.
All right, James.
Love that theme song.
Oh, it's great. what are we talking about today?
We got a two-hander, I think they call it in the biz.
Yeah, exactly. That's definitely what they would refer to this podcast as. Definitely not a farce. That's not what they would refer to this as.
The Scientology documentary Going Clear.
Correct. Scientology and the Prison of Belief is the subtitle.
Sure.
Yeah.
And Mission Impossible
Rogue Nation is the subtitle.
Yeah, there you go. I was trying to remember if there was a number in it, but they don't do that anymore.
No, they gave that up when they started accepting ghost protocols.
Right.
Yep. We're in a post numbers world for Ethan Hunt.
They had to choose numbers or hoodies.
Despite the fact that this movie revolves around him memorizing a lot of numbers, they are in a post numbers world.
Fact.
Yeah.
Yes, with the link between them being our boy Tom Cruise, who.
Yes.
We have discussed before, but remain fascinated by. Do you want to explain why you chose to do both of these together, or is that,
I think it kind of it works better as when we start talking about Mission Impossible. I think if we just sort of save it,
little teaser for you,
Peter. Yeah. If you're a fan of insane conspiracy theories, stick around for a little bit because it's about to get real.
Okay.
And when I say real, I mean not real at all. But.
Okay, so does that mean we're starting with Going Clear?
Yeah, I think that makes the most sense.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let's go clear.
Yeah. It's an enjoyable documentary. Like, it's a really well-put-together movie and clearly has a pretty high budget. Like, the interviews are gorgeous. It's a fairly standard documentary style, but just done really well. And I feel like the way that it presents Scientology is good because it doesn't go right into the... shall we say, like, the Scientology tone that people tend to take when talking about Scientology, the tone that we will probably take up at some point in this conversation, where
what
it's like,
mean?
It's so obviously stupid, how can anybody take it seriously, sort of thing, you know what I mean?
Yeah, there's, I think a lot of people kind of our age, really, maybe they didn't see the episode, but around the time that South Park did an episode of Scientology, I think is when a lot of... you know, maybe of our peers started figuring out just what Scientology is.
Yeah.
And yeah, that focused more on all the Xenu stuff and the souls and the volcanoes. And this movie definitely does touch on that. And it does touch on it, you know, in a condescending way. You know, Paul Haggis says, you know, if this is what we started with, I never would have believed in it. You know, I liked all this stuff. You know, and he's speaking very reasonably. I liked all the things they said about, you know, just trying to consider your memories and your experiences and how those have affected you and how to communicate more effectively with people. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of just more self-helpy, you know, a certain subsection of psychology or pseudo-pop psychology for some people. Mm-hmm. Right. And this movie was not, you know, a feature-length film just saying the most ridiculous things that people who believe in Scientology subscribe to.
Yeah.
It does sound like there is 2 hours worth of crazy shit Scientologists believe in.
I would have watched a whole 2-hour documentary about the Bohemian Rhapsody thing. Like,
oh, that was so weird.
Oh my God.
I mean, they certainly do touch on that, and they certainly do look down on Scientology for its fundamental beliefs about the history of the world.
Mm-hmm.
But not nearly as much as they could have, or as much as I was suspecting. And just to say one thing, that to touch on something that you mentioned about this movie being pretty, you know, pretty straightforward in a lot of ways, just done well. I agree. I think it looks really good. There clearly was a lot of money behind it, and I think they kind of had the money to actually have an overall aesthetic to it. You know, that the thing of the names and captions and chyrons and things being presented with the E-meter look kind of slowly fading in.
Yeah.
The visual stuff like that, that you just don't always have a budget to do with documentaries, because documentaries often don't have a high budget because they don't make a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
But HBO kind of knew they had something, and they did dump some money into this. And
Alex Gibney is a respected documentary director as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And the book, you know, had a lot of heat on it too.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I mean, that amount of money just kind of gives it that through line of visuals that really makes it seem like a complete whole and just not one other person piling on Scientology. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I thought it, yeah, I just agree that it did look very good.
Yeah. And, you know, what we were talking about with the whole, you know, lack of a condescending tone for most of it is, I think it's kind of set out by, Lawrence Wright. That's the author's name, correct? Of the book?
I do not know.
Okay. I'm pretty confident that it's Lawrence Wright. Anyway.
Books are for nerds.
Yeah. Okay.
Podcasts are for cool people.
And, like he explains it at the beginning, like his idea was always just like, he wanted to start to try and wrap his head around these things. Like he just wanted to understand. He didn't necessarily want, you know, the more salacious things probably pulled him in, but he wanted to understand what led to those things being allowed to exist, you know? And I think that's something that kind of exists throughout the whole documentary. It's this sort of, this pervasive feeling of just trying to understand. And there's all these crazy things that are outlined throughout the movie, but it always comes back to just wanting to understand it. And the fact that they all just kind of end up coming back to like very logical things, like the way that, L. Ron Hubbard for so long is trying to get Scientology seen as a religion, and how when that eventually does happen, I believe after Hubbard's death, it basically saves Scientology once the government recognizes it as a religion, because then they don't have to pay all their taxes back. That's like a really real world logical reason for Scientology to be able to continue to exist, and I had no idea about that, and I thought that was really fascinating. And just the fact that so much of what happened after that relied on being able to build on a, you know, tax rules.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think, as you said, the subtitle is The Prison of Belief.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of, you know, like, you know, just to say that South Park episode, you can make fun of someone's beliefs for about 20 minutes and it can be funny. But I mean, beyond that, it's not going to be that interesting. You know what I mean? Like, people believe dumb stuff, and, you know, you can get up on your high horse and laugh at that. But I think at a, you know, that for 2 hours, I think, would really run out of steam. This is, I found this was more of not just kind of, these people are so dumb because they believe in Lord Xenu and this space prison and all these kinds of things. The interesting part is why they would believe it and why they would stay with it and why after all these things that they've gone through,
mm-hmm.
You know, they continue to believe, or they stay with the church, or they disconnect with people and their family. It's more about, you know, psychology and addiction and things like that than it is just about the, you know, flimsy foundation that this religion is based on. Mm-hmm. And to me, that is just, you know, I think 1,000 times more interesting. And I think that's why this movie was kind of as successful as it was. And I think now's the time to point out that it was very successful. Like, for an HBO movie, for a documentary, you know, it gained a lot of traction. It made a lot of money.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. And I think part of the, another part of the appeal is simply that there were celebrities involved. And I think that's why Scientology is on so many more people's radar than other, you know, religions, cults, belief systems, whatever you want to term it as.
Mm-hmm.
Were you surprised by how little celebrity stuff there was in this movie?
No. I feel like there was the appropriate amount, at least from my perspective. Because, like, I mean, did you feel like there was something missing on that front?
No, I don't mean this from a, you know, if you were in the editing room, would you have made things different? But did you think, you know, I'll say for myself, I thought that people, for the most part, are interested in Scientology, not because it's so crazy, because as we said, there's a lot of crazy things people believe. But the, you know, celebrité of the people who, of some of the people who follow it, like the Tom Cruises, the John Travoltas, you know, there's a lot of other very famous people who...
Giovanni Ribisi.
Giovanni Ribisi. Leah Remini. Yeah.
Formerly.
Yeah, I just thought that maybe because that's what I think gets it on so many people's radar, it would be something that would be leaned on with a bit more strength.
No, because I thought, because it's always been, and I mean, we were both kids in the 90s, so it's kind of hard to really assess, but my understanding of the rise of Scientology in the public eye has been that it's mostly tied to Tom Cruise's celebrity, and to a lesser extent, John Travolta. But I've always felt like the reason I heard about Scientology for the first time is probably tied to Tom Cruise. And I feel like this movie kind of covers it enough. It doesn't, and they, you know, they really point to Travolta and Cruise as kind of like the two two of the bigger lights in Scientology. But I don't think they go over the top with it, and I don't think it lacks anything. I feel like it ties it in well without going too far, you know? Because I would have, if this whole movie was like Tom Cruise and his relationship to Scientology, it's a much worse movie that I might be actually more fascinated with. But it wouldn't. But as a movie, it wouldn't be as good. You know?
Yeah, I think it would be more interesting to you, but maybe overall. Not.
Yeah, exactly.
Because I mean, if we're looking at this movie in a three-act structure, you know, the first act is former Scientologists. I mean, we get to know a lot of people who were involved and left the church. That's basically all the talking heads we get.
Yeah, exactly.
In this movie.
Yeah.
You know, we have them getting into it, and then the second third is basically we go back to the beginning of Scientology and some of those things you're discussing about L. Ron Hubbard and how it became legitimate in the eyes of the government for those tax breaks and things like that. And then the third act is really just how bad things get. You know, like talking about, you know, like David Miscavige and the leadership and, you know, the stories about the hole and all these things like that, just how bad things get. And again, not through the lens of, isn't it crazy that, you know, this is how old they think the earth is and this is where they think souls comes from and there's something called a thetan. Yeah. It's what happens when you believe not those things, but things that you know, really warp your sense of reality, and things that just a belief system that requires you to be all in and puts you in a place where you're out of sync with so many other people in your life. Mm-hmm. And I'm struggling to not take a super condescending tone to this, the subject matter of Scientology, not because I'm a big supporter of it, but because I think, you know, just the way that this movie succeeds by not just shitting on it for being goofy, but really exploring what, you know, addictions and you know, cults and just anything that makes you think differently than the people around you and separates you from the people you were friends with before, family with before, and things like that. And that's definitely the more fascinating part to me, and definitely clearly to the filmmakers as well, the more interesting part.
Yeah, the thing I find the most fascinating about the movie, and even removed from the more intense stories that exist in the third act, as you defined it, is kind of the way that the movie really transitions to being about something about the abuse of power. And David Miscavige just kind of seeming like a guy with a god complex who's just a terrible person. And the movie doesn't put the believers at fault so much as the system that they that belief is built on, and yeah. how that system ends up taking advantage of them. And I think, like, in that capacity, I find the movie very fascinating, because, you know, then you can kind of see it as pretty much anything that becomes too big for its britches, and or the whole absolute power corrupts absolutely sort of thing. And we don't get a lot of perspective from Miskovich, so maybe he's not this person or whatever, but and maybe he at one point was a normal human being, but the way the movie paints him, it's kind of like, pretty much he's just this power hungry guy, and he eventually ends up destroying a lot of lives by this with this thing that he runs. Yeah,
and I think it's just the way that we talk about some of the people being kind of victims of this belief system. Mm-hmm. You know, there's someone who didn't have anything to do with the formation of the religion. They come along. Haggis is so interesting to listen to.
Oh my God.
It's crazy.
Like every piece that, like, everything he says in this movie is better than anything he's ever written. You know, like, it's crazy to me. Like, he's such a fascinating speaker. He has an amazing voice as well. It, like, this weird, like, calming Canadian voice. It's so bizarre. Like, if Northern Exposure needed a narrator today, I would nominate him. I feel like that would be perfect. But yeah, he's just such a fascinating guy to listen to, and he seems like he's got such an interesting perspective on everything. And you know, I shouldn't say he's never done anything I don't like, but I was very surprised by how pro Paul Haggis I became over the course of this the course of this movie.
Right. Yeah. But as I was saying, it's you know, we follow the, you know, through these confessionals, whatever you want to call them, talking heads moments, you know, with him and Spanky.
Yes.
let's get that out of the way.
Yeah, it had to be mentioned at some point.
Yeah. All my notes for this movie is just Spanky in 128 point no, I mean, we follow their journey a little bit. Like, they give us their history about how they got into it, you know, not knowing about it and kind of slowly getting into it and then being all in on it and then seeing the danger of it and getting out. And, you know, there's L. Ron Hubbard in here, but there's not a ton of them. There's less than I expected, to be quite honest.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Who's a fascinating figure in his own right, but I find him really hard to watch speak. I find something really unsettling about him.
Yes, I would agree. And you know what's weird about it? He looks like Christopher Nolan mixed with Alfred Hitchcock, and it's kind of weird.
And what's Buffalo Bill? And his voice, too. But anyway, you know, there's not a ton of L. Ron Hubbard stuff. I think there's more Miscavige stuff, you know?
Yeah.
I think that's what I was getting at, is what's interesting about that is he's not the one who made it all. He's someone who kind of saw it already in motion, you know what I mean? And just the way that some of these believers, I guess, I honestly don't know the proper term, you know, people who follow I guess Scientologists, that's probably the word. You know, these people who come along and get involved, you know, as adherents to the faith. And then we have Miscavige, who kind of comes along, sees this, and sees he wants to be on the top of it. And so we have these people who kind of become victims of the system. And then we have him, who kind of becomes a perpetuator of it. You know what I mean? Like, he sees his spot in this as a way for him to continue, like him to get bigger, him to do his thing.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? I think that's kind of the other side of the coin that's still interesting. Like, he's not the L. Ron Hubbard in this situation. He's not just another person who goes into the, you know, one of their centers and passes a test and kind of starts slipping into it. Mm-hmm. He's got his own view of what it can do for him and his life.
Yeah, exactly. I think there's a real theme throughout this movie, or, you know, there's various points in this movie where you can see somebody seeing an opportunity and in a debatably nefarious way kind of takes hold of it. L. Ron Hubbard sees a way to kind of make his lifestyle viable. So he tries to get Scientology turned into a religion. and or he sees this spot in the, I suppose, for lack of a better term, market, where he can, you know, put Dianetics and maybe people will latch onto it and support it. And then he sort of sees, oh, the religion is the way to go. Let's make that happen. Then David Miscavige sees this kind of this space for somebody at the top, like L. Ron Hubbard's getting older, or maybe he's, you know, he's on the run from the law for the however long, the last decade of his life, or maybe even longer. And so David Miscavige can see this place to step in, and he just constantly keeps taking, or he's able to step in, takes control when L. Ron dies, and things keep progressing, and he continues to be at the top. It's just all of these opportunities being seized, and in debatably nefarious ways, you know, and I don't know. I think that's really fascinating. Just this whole dialogue between somebody seeing an opportunity to be taken, but that opportunity always relying on potentially taking advantage of other human beings in some capacity. You know?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think it's fascinating watching how people got involved at, you know, the lowest level, but it's, this was a very interesting documentary about the people who are at the top of it, you know, or near the top, or want, or aspiring to be the top. You know, it's not just about, you know, L. Ron Hubbard told all these crazy lies. He was a sci-fi author. How could you ever believe anything he said about space? Mm-hmm. You know, we have people like Miscavige and Rathburn and all these other people who see it as an opportunity, not just as a way to make things, to deal with things the way that we think about, you know, faith and religion and other systems of belief, a way to just help themselves out personally. It seems to be something bigger than, something grander than that, something with more hubris and more malice than for just following a faith, you know?
Yeah, for sure. You were talking a bit about how you feel like watching Hubbard speak is a little bit disturbing. I feel that way about David Miscavige. Pretty much every time I've had to look at him in this movie, I'm just like, it just weirds me out a little bit. Even when he's in a picture with Tom Cruise and they're both just staring at the camera, I can't like avoid looking at him and being slightly off put by him. Yeah. He just seems like, he just has this like this vibe to him. And he just looks like such a ween, which doesn't help. But
I maintain that Miscavige is functioning on two planes simultaneously, whereas L. Ron Hubbard was through and through one person.
Okay, fair enough.
And I don't know which one of those is worse.
Okay.
But that's kind of where I am with that.
Okay, that's fair.
Did you expect to see more Tom Cruise, or how did you feel like he ended up being depicted?
I don't want to, unfairly is too strong of a word, but bordering on unfair. I feel like there's this moment late in the movie, and it's very quick, and it doesn't fit with the rest of the documentary, I don't think, even though it does kind of lead to interesting thoughts. But I forget even who says it, but it's like Tom, it said, it's something along the lines of Tom Cruise had, like, we don't know why he doesn't speak out about Scientology. Like, we don't understand why he wouldn't. And it just kind of assumes that this person would join their cause for a reason, you know, just because they immediately believe in, you know, Marty Rathburn and those guys speaking out against Scientology. And that part I felt was a little unfair. Do you know what I'm talking about? Because it happens right towards the end of the movie.
No, I'm trying to remember.
It's so quick. Like, it makes sense that you wouldn't forget. It's like in the wrap-up. Somebody just throws it in.
But they say something like, they don't understand why Tom Cruise wouldn't
speak out about Scientology. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And it's just, I don't know, it's odd. And it seems to come out of nowhere. But I feel like the section around, you know, the hour mark of the movie or so, where they talk about him for a fairly extended period, doesn't make him come off very well at all, but they seem to be talking to people with at least some sort of inner knowledge, and if there's some element of truth to it, then Tom's not the best, you know.
What made him look bad, do you think?
Him screaming at his girlfriend for having a headache around David Miscavige, that's a little problematic. And all of the stuff with the girlfriend, pretty much.
I thought a lot of the stuff with the girlfriend looked worse on Scientology than on him. Like, it seemed like he was their poster. And I'm not trying to make excuses for him.
Yeah.
I'm just saying it seemed like they understood that they had kind of a poster boy and they were doing him. And yeah, I think, you know, a good person would go out of their way to make sure people don't do things like that on their behalf.
Yeah.
But I just wasn't sure how privy he was to any of that kind of knowledge. I thought he came off looking much closer to morally neutral than I expected this documentary to paint him in.
Yeah, okay, that's fair. Yeah, I think certainly the majority of the things, they kind of paint him as ignorant. And whether...
He's just being glib.
yes, I agree that you are right that most of the things that are described in the movie, I feel like could have happened without him, without his knowledge at all, without Tom Cruise's knowledge at all. But there's just, I don't know, I feel like there's just these hints of like him being so offended. It's just that one scene where I think it's Marty Rathbun talks about how Tom Cruise screams at his Scientology girlfriend for quote unquote being rude to David Miscavige when he visits.
Yeah, I understand that. And I guess I don't know. I have a hard time just because I think I got in some trouble saying this about Carrie's mother on our Carrie podcast too. His heart might be in the right place. Mm-hmm. You know, it never seems as though he's saying, Scientology is the best and we're going to let everyone else die. And all the Scientologists are going to be the only one who lives. Just in him speaking at that meeting, and I think it was in 2006 or something. That might not be right.
It's the 2004 Freedom Medal of Valor speech that you're talking about?
Yes, 2004. There it is. And even Tom Cruise even John Travolta talking about how it's one of the only religions that joy is important and addressing mental illness is important. And the idea of a religion really putting mental illness on the forefront seems like really, really progressive to me. He talks about how are people, Tom Cruise at that Medal of Valor speech, talks about how are people going to remember you? Are they going to remember you as someone who tried to make the world better for for the people around you and for the whole planet? And it just seemed like, maybe because I had a certain expectation that the footage of, you know, what we were going to see when it's just only Scientologists in the room was going to be a lot more, cloak and dagger and a lot more selfish and just purely promoting their faith. It came off as very, very genuine and very moral. I don't know. I'm not going to be subscribing to Scientology anytime soon, but it just seemed like, and I know that's a prepared speech to be performed in public and he was aware there are cameras and things like that. So it's not the same thing as, you know, a hidden tape recorder.
And it's a talented actor rehearsing a speech as well.
You know? Yeah, that's true. And a charismatic, likable, good looking actor, I'm aware.
Yeah.
It never really rang nefarious to me in the way that I was expecting it to be.
No, that speech certainly doesn't. And I never feel like when Tom Cruise is in front of cameras, he never feels nefarious to me. He always just he feels like a very earnest sort of person. And there's just, it's mostly just these hints throughout the movie that maybe, maybe he goes along with some things that he shouldn't go along with. But you are correct in that they are only hints.
Yeah. And, I mean, turning a blind eye to things is...
Yeah, that's... ignorance is never a good excuse in my eyes, you know?
There are men that do evil...
Sorry?
Allow evil things to happen. There are men that do bad things, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, do you want to talk about Mission Impossible? Do you have anything else on Going Clear?
Not really.
Do you want to talk about why you wanted to connect the two, or do you want to get to Mission Impossible?
Well,
first?
Okay, so I was watching Mission Impossible because it's a Mission Impossible movie, so why wouldn't I see it? I like Tommy. I like action movies. Why not?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm watching this movie, and Lane, the villain of this movie, I just kind of like, about halfway through the movie, I started thinking, like, what if I just watch the rest of this movie imagining that Lane is a stand-in for David Miscavige? And this movie is about Tom Cruise's modern relationship with Scientology. And so that's what I did. And and I will say, like, this was inspired by me kind of, like, for half a second thinking he looked like David Miscavige. And I saw Going Clear months before, like, when it first came out, which I think was early May. So it's not like I had recently seen it. You know, this is now the end of July when I'm watching Mission Impossible. And in my defense, if you, like, squint and pretend that Lane looks like David Miscavige, he looks like David Miscavige.
And Dana Carvey.
Yes. But anyway, he was just such, like, and the way he talked was just so, like, such an over-the-top villain to me, and I really got a kick out of him. And anyway, I just sort of just wanted to think about Cruise's producerial power a little bit as well, and I sort of started to think about it as him kind of making this statement about his own relationship with Scientology these days. Because what we were talking about, the Freedom Medal of Valor speech, that happens around 2004, right? That's the year that Collateral comes out. Everything's still fine and dandy in Tom Cruise's world. Next summer, the following summer, is the War of the Worlds tour, the publicity tour, which is where the couch jumping incident happens on Oprah. And it's where the glib thing happens with Matt Lauer. It's right after Tom Cruise fires his longtime publicist. And who I heard last...
Wasn't the Smash people. And War of the Worlds wasn't the Smash people want it to be either, right?
It made plenty of money. That's sort of the thing, is that the publicity tour totally overshadowed the fact that it was a huge hit. It didn't, you know, it wasn't Avatar, but it made plenty of money. But
Domestic?
Yeah. I honestly don't know.
Okay.
That movie did fine, though, is what I'm saying. Yeah, so this is just after he fires his lead publicist. Her last name's Kingsley, I think. It might be Pam Kingsley. But it's somebody that, you know, Tom Cruise was notoriously protected throughout the 80s and the 90s and early 2000s in interviews. And there were even rules about his, you know, anytime he signed on to do an interview for anything, after the final interview had aired, all of the raw footage had to be destroyed. And this is something that's very uncommon. And it's just something that Kingsley did to protect Tom Cruise for whatever reason. And he fires her in 2004, 2005, somewhere around there, because he wants to start focusing more on science. Scientology. And if you, when you're watching Going Clear, you see the movie really point to him sort of David Miscavige wanting to bring him back into the Scientology fold around the mid-2000s. And that's around the time he fires his publicist, and things really turn against him in general, publicity wise you know, he jumps on the couch, calls Matt Lauer glib. The perception of War of the Worlds is that it doesn't do well, even though it does, simply because of how we now see Tom Cruise. And I don't know if you remember when Mission Impossible 3 was being made, Scarlett Johansson was initially attached to it, as was the director, Joe Carnahan, before J.J. Abrams came in. And Scarlett Johansson has talked about how she left the movie because she felt like Tom Cruise tried to get her into Scientology and it made her uncomfortable. And so it's this time when he's really leaning into Scientology. And it's also this time when Tom Cruise is possibly liked the least by culture as a whole, you know. And it's not until like 2009, Tropic Thunder comes out, where we start to turn back pro Cruise, and Ghost Protocol is when we really get back on board in this big mass budget way, where he is the centerpiece. And so I kind of feel like he's gone through this transition period of maybe realizing that either he doesn't belong in Scientology anymore, or he just shouldn't talk about Scientology anymore. And maybe he got taken advantage of in the mid-2000s, and that's what he feels about it now. And so he's making these feelings known in this movie. And it's unsurprising that he gets trapped in a sort of small glass prison at the beginning of the movie by the villain, you know, and just sort of gets taken advantage of at that point. And he's kind of lumped in as like, he's not that different from Lane as far as their training and all that stuff and their belief system in some capacity. It's just there's a nefariousness to Lane that Ethan Hunt just doesn't have. And I feel like if you kind of watch their relationship throughout the movie, it really does feel like a movie about Ethan Hunt, or sorry, Tom Cruise seeing David Miscavige as a villain that has kind of operated in the shadows and taken advantage of him a little bit, you know?
Yeah, and trying to kind of lead him down a certain path, and he follows for a bit and ultimately rejects.
Yeah, exactly. And eventually, like, he is able to literally topple Lane, you know? He traps him in a prison, and the last thing Tom Cruise does of any sort of physical act in the movie is push that thing over. Like, it's like, you're trapped, but I'm also going to knock you over, you know? Like, and it's just, I don't know. I understand that theory is at least moderately insane, but I don't know. I see a little bit of it, and it also allows me to look at Tom Cruise in a brighter light, which I enjoy.
Yeah, I mean, we have a clear match, you know, of him being put in, you know, after he listens to that record from the girl in the record shop, mm-hmm. And, you know, gets boxed in and gassed, and eventually we have the revenge moment, as you said, of him getting Solomon Lane into a box and gassing him. And then, yeah, the toppling kind of, I've done the same thing to you, but I've done it. Yeah. That much more. You know
yeah,
what
yeah
I mean?
Exactly.
Like, I see why we're even now, but you went out of your way to get in my way. So it goes a bit further with you.
Yeah.
Good. I mean, we'll see over the next few years if, any of that works out.
Well, yeah.
But it's a good take. And when you told me about wanting to connect these two movies, it kind of put that idea in my mind of watching this movie through the lens of Going Clear and, mm-hmm. you know, looking at Lane or any of the characters or organizations in Rogue Nation as Scientology. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, we're five movies into the franchise now. Mm-hmm. So it's, there really is a lot of backstory here by this point. And, you know, it's 19 or 20 years old, five movies in. For my money, one of the most interesting franchises going right now.
I think we're kind of losing that interest. It's still a franchise that I will probably see every installment of this movie. Or of the series, as long as Tom Cruise is involved. But I do think, you know, I mean, we did a podcast about Ghost Protocol. Neither of us was particularly crazy about it. I love Mission Impossible 3, which I don't think is the standard opinion to have of that movie, partially because I think it's colored by the way people saw Tom Cruise in 2006.
Yeah.
But I feel like they've really sort of, despite the directors still changing, they've kind of gotten more cookie cutter post 3. Like, they're still under the J.J. Abrams umbrella, like 4 and 5 have been, and there's still this there's a feeling of cohesiveness to 4 and 5 that I feel like didn't exist between 1, 2, and 3. Those are such different movies.
Yeah. You know? Well, because number 1, Brian De Palma?
Yes.
It feels just like a John le Carré novel,
yeah,
you know, put through cinema, and then the jump to John Woo,
yeah, which is like in retrospect so cool. Like, even though Mission Impossible 2 is a terrible movie, I saw like an hour of it on TV a few months ago and was like, Jesus Christ, this is garbage, but like in an entertaining way. But the fact that they were just they made that jump is so fascinating.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah, so I mean, those are the big jumps, and I think you're right about 4 and 5 being much closer. And I think it's interesting to think. I mean, Fast and Furious 5 is where we all agree that franchise kind of hit its stride. You
yeah,
know what I
for
mean?
Sure.
And yeah, for this movie 4 and 5, it seems like maybe I don't know if they hit their stride at 4, but at least I think they found their formula at 4. We can keep changing directors, but we've kind of got
yeah
this. It's not purely a director sandbox anymore, you know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly.
They know what they're coming into.
Yeah. And I like Christopher McQuarrie as a director in general, but I strongly suspect he was chosen as the director because after working with him on Jack Reacher, which Macquarie directed, Tom Cruise was like, yeah, this guy will be good to work with and also won't mind, you know, fitting into our vision, you know?
Well, and did he write Edge of Tomorrow too?
I think he did, yeah.
So I think maybe they've got an understanding about Tom Cruise will pitch Scientology every once in a while, just deal with it and keep working.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And I mean, we know Cruise has enough power to get the people he wants involved with his movies.
Yeah, exactly. And he's a producer on all the Mission Impossible movies, like specifically the Mission Impossible movies he has a lot of control over.
Oh, yeah, yeah, that's what I mean. But just thinking about, you know, how long this franchise has been around for, and to your point that it's something that Cruise has had a lot to do with, mm-hmm. beyond being the star. And
like, I strongly suspect the director switch is his idea initially. And I think that's cool.
Yeah, it is really cool.
Yeah.
I just think that, and I don't think it's going to be the way, this couldn't be something that I think the way that Cruise is thinking about this, but I think just like your, you know, just like the theory you described about your reading of the movie, I think there is a cool reading to be done, especially a few years down the road, about IMF being the Church of Scientology and, you know, where we see Ethan, I always say Ethan Hawke, I don't mean it. that's why I'm speaking so slowly. Yeah. Where Ethan Hunt is now is he has given a lot to this organization. Mm-hmm. And it has provided him with a lot of pleasure and pain. Now, maybe pleasure is not the right word, but obviously Ethan does enjoy what he does for his job in some capacity, or he'd walk away. Mm-hmm. It's not like in every movie they have a hostage that says you need to do this for us or we're gonna kill your wife. Now stuff like that does happen,
yeah,
but it's not,
and constant. Sometimes wives disappear and nobody mentions them again.
She's in witness protection,
is that true?
Yeah, it's tidied up.
Okay, sure.
Yeah, it sounds right. And, you know, it's brought him a lot of fulfillment. I guess it's given him a direction. But at the same time, it's caused him tons of pain. It's had loved ones get killed, friends get killed in front of him. Mm-hmm. You know, the wife that he has. I believe it is canon that she is in witness protection. And
I remember, we're talking about Michelle Monaghan's character, her popping up at the end of Ghost Protocol, just for like, let's all meet on a dock and have a picnic or something. But I don't remember what they talk about, if anything, or what gets tied up. But.
Oh, okay, I believe it is. She is in witness protection and he still cares about her, but he can't see her because they'll just do more stuff to her.
Fair enough.
He loves her too much to let that happen.
Yeah, and his parents are threatened in the first movie as well. Go with what you're talking about.
Yeah, that's true, but I don't think it's not constantly this idea that he's a victim. I think he's complicit in a lot of things that IMF does, and he certainly believes in a lot of things that they do, and there are instances throughout the franchise where he acts in a way that he knows is going to be create problems for him, but it's going to save the life of a bunch of innocent people.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that, you know, is kind of I would guess the mission statement of the Impossible Mission Force. which is such a good name.
It's so good.
And so, I mean, that's where I see a cool reading of his relationship to Scientology, is that it's given him so much, but it's also caused so many problems for him. Because I genuinely believe Tom Cruise attributes a lot of his continued success to Scientology. I know he wasn't, you know, that's not why he thinks Rain Man did well, but I think that's why he thinks he's possibly the last living movie star, mm-hmm. in the classical sense of the word, why he has made so much money and still has so much power and fame, because of the teachings of Scientology. I feel like he would tell you that. So it's brought him a lot of good things, but it's also brought him so much negative publicity. And as you said, that spell around the mid-2000s, so much of that would have to do with Scientology. And so I think where we get to in this movie is this level where he's kind of questioning whether or not it's all worth it, and whether all these things that he is kind of received in a positive light are worth all the negativity it brings him. And when this mission's over, you know, what does he have? And I have a bit of a problem that talk about with where the Bourne franchise and the Bond franchise and the Mission Impossible franchise are. That I believe the last two Mission Impossible movies, a lot of Bourne, definitely Skyfall. The plot is that our protagonist is, you know, disowned or disavowed or for some reason can't be part of the organization that he treasures dearly. And
well, I mean, the Bourne movies are built on that.
Yeah, that's what I mean. The Bourne movies are all that.
Once again, the Bourne movies are incredibly influential because the Bond reboot is directly influenced by the Bourne movies. And I believe it's my belief that the Mission Impossible, not quite reboot, but sort of J.J. Abramsing, is at least moderately Bourne influenced.
Right, yeah. I just mean, I think that they're all in the same spot where over the last few movies, you know, as you said, probably all of the Bourne movies, at least Skyfall, and the last two Mission Impossible movies, Ghost Protocol and Rogue Nation, he's functioning kind of outside of the system that got him there.
Yeah.
And that I don't like that. I really don't like that they're all kind of in the same spot. And on our Bourne podcast, which is a long time ago now, we talked about how that's a response to Afghanistan and Iraq and being part of the American public when the American military is doing things that they're not really really behind or really understand in a meaningful way, that, you know, in the way that at least now people understand World War II and could kind of get behind a lot of the things that that war was supposed to be about. Mm-hmm. And I just don't know if... I just don't know how these franchises get somewhere out of that kind of hamster wheel unless there's just another massive war that everyone gets behind. Do you know what I mean? It just feels like between Rogue Nation and Ghost Protocol, and I'll say that I really did enjoy Rogue Nation a lot. I thought I had a very good time watching it. I thought it was a very good action movie.
I would agree.
I just don't know if we can kind of spin our wheels in that discontented public mud for much longer without it feeling stale.
Yeah, I think it's just sort of a continuation of the whole cop being removed from the case sort of thing. Like, I need your badge and your gun. You're suspended for 2 weeks, and then they just go off and solve the case anyway. It's just that, but cop movies have been replaced by giant blockbusters, and so it just has to be bigger. So it's a... I don't have as much of a problem with it as you do. I think it would be cool to sort of go the other way with it because I, as a contrarian, I feel like that's kind of typically a very good way to go about things. But yeah, I don't know. I have less of a problem with it than you.
Okay. Yeah. So now that you mention, you know, this in relation to a cop movie and just kind of the general trend of action getting bigger and bigger, how did you feel about the stakes of this movie, which is another thing we talk about?
Big fan.
Big fan. Okay. Why is that?
Not huge stakes. Like, they're large stakes in a sense, but... and it's funny, Travis and I, the other night, the Lightbox was showing The Dark Knight, so we went to go see it, because we heard it was the hottest film of 2008, so we should finally finally check it out.
Right.
But we were talking about it afterwards, that it was really amazing how... that movie, the stakes are so low, like immediately, the immediate stakes, and even in the climax, the highest number of people that are ever at like risk of mortal injury is like 200, maybe, you know? And
which sounds like a lot, but that's one Hulk stomp, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And so we were talking about it and how, like, towards the end, I was thinking, like, in my head as I'm watching the movie, I'm like, man, these people are really being put through the ringer. And that's something that I just never think of when the scale is on the scale of, like, the Avengers or something like that, where the whole world is at stake. But anyway, I felt the same way about Rogue Nation, is that you can use the term people because you feel like there's at least some semblance of humanity in these people because we're not setting up so many different things that are happening. And the climax of the movie is pretty small, all things considered. It's people running through streets, you know, and it's about five of them. And I found that really interesting. And the fact that, again, it's, you know, even lower than The Dark Knight, that, you know, there's never a huge number of people whose deaths are immediately at stake, you know?
Yeah, I mean, we understand Solomon Lane is responsible for the syndicate, which is cities around the world and things like that. But yeah, in that immediate scene, you're right, it is five people whose first and last names we could tell you pretty much, you know. Which is a big distance. Speaking of that, I really, really enjoyed the action set piece at the opera.
Oh, it was amazing. It was so good.
I thought that was like one of the best action pieces I've seen in a while.
Yeah.
I was really pleased about that. And kind of on the same token of things being small, when they were fighting on, I'm going to call it a catwalk, even though that's not the right term for it. When they were fighting on the catwalk above the stage while it's going on, and they both kind of have that moment where they look at each other and they realize it's in their best interest to both be quiet. Like, we're going to fight to the death, but if one of our bodies falls on the stage, it's not good for anybody.
Yeah.
And then they kind of have this like small little battle. And then, for a set piece in a big action movie, I love all the characters involved and having, you know, Benji hitting those machines, which starts the other catwalks moving, and gave me a great visual when Tom Cruise is being choked from behind and then the catwalk like makes him taller, like to point out how he is shorter at the point, and then it like makes him taller. And then I don't know, I thought that was just a really cool visual metaphor, you know, like every time Tom Cruise runs, which we get in this movie, is just that like he works harder or he has more people or he has gadgets or he has ingenuity. Like there's just something about this that you just can't keep this force down, because even though, yeah, he's shorter, whatever, there's all these other things and determination and all these other moving parts that will make him succeed in the end, which is such a Cruise-ism at this point,
but
it was still really, really cool to watch play out in a fight scene that, even outside of that, is very, very fun to watch.
Yeah, it's just a good action sequence. Something within, towards the end of that sequence that I loved that ties into something that you talked about is when we see Ethan Hunt decide to shoot the Chancellor, because he's got one bullet and there are two people with guns aimed at the Chancellor, we don't hear him vocalize it. He's like, okay, I'm gonna shoot Dolph Lundgren. No, I'm gonna shoot Ilsa. No, but they both have guns. What do I do? Oh, I shoot the Chancellor. We just see him looking, you know, and the movie is able to communicate to us that he is realizing something and making a decision, and it doesn't have to be vocalized at all. And then he just shoots the Chancellor. He pulls the opening of Speed, you know, and he just shoots the hostage. And I thought that sequence that moment was really great, because it shows, you know, it uses the visual elements of film to get across an idea and to show a character making a decision. And the other moment that I liked that was like that is right after the water sequence, when we see Benji come back to them, there's a moment where we see Benji realize purely visually that he can trust Ilsa. And I thought that was it's a smaller moment, but it's another moment like that where we see a character realize something and act on it without it ever being vocalized in any way.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, and then he eventually says, you know, Benji says, I was wrong. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, you know, we can see him come to the decision and then he talks about the decision.
Right. Do you want to talk about Ilsa?
Yeah. I was a big fan. Like, I can't even cogently explain why. I thought Rebecca Ferguson was just great in this movie.
Yeah,
I don't understand why, but I just thought she was great.
A lot of people really seem to be getting on board with this.
Yeah, I can't explain it. I just thought she was great. She's really, a really like charismatic person, I guess.
Yeah, and I don't know. Some people are saying that she kind of made a good equal for Cruz and just kind of had a certain confidence succeeded in the same ways that he did, in the same manner. We don't see her just get matched up with a female to fight, which is always a nice thing for a female in an action movie. How did you feel about the relationship between the two of them?
Well, I mean, that's one of the problems I have with this movie, is that there's like an element of humanity to these characters, but never really a moment that Oh, I don't even know how to describe it. It's all so like sleek, like it's all plot based. And Richard Brody actually wrote a really good piece about this. I believe he called it Christopher Nolanitis, about how everything is just related to the plot, and we don't really get moments of humanity. And I feel like both Ethan and Ilsa kind of fall to this, is that they don't really ever get anything particularly human to do. They're just kind of robots that continue to move forward in order to help the plot move. And I don't think that necessarily makes the movie worse, but it, I don't know. I care about them less because of it, you know, which, and that's another reason why I don't understand why I enjoyed Rebecca Ferguson's performance so much. Cause I feel like she was playing like a cardboard cutout character, you know?
Right. But I guess that's better than the, damsel in distress.
Oh, 100%. Obviously. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I did one shot that really bummed me out in the movie is where we see her getting changed after swimming. That bummed me out. I didn't like it. No pun intended. it was a shot from 10 years ago and I didn't like it.
Yeah. It seems pretty unnecessary.
Yeah.
Did you believe, her motives to be true when she wants to run away with, Ethan?
Mm.
And whether that is or not, does that change any of your opinions on her as a female character?
It does not change my opinions, because I think that kind of plays into the whole the idea I have about it just being sort of these people are cookie cutter versions of people that we just know so well that we assume, like, that we know what they're going to do, because, you know, at the end, towards the end of these movies, the male and the female always talk about running away together. You know, it's just sort of this entrenched formula. No, I don't think it makes me like her less. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I
would prefer if it didn't exist in the movie, because I just enjoy platonic relationships in movies in general, because there are about five of them over the course of cinema history.
Yeah. Yeah. Did you enjoy her as an extended Casablanca reference?
I'm not going to say no, but I'm also not going to say yes. I'm pretty in the middle on that. Did you have any feelings about it?
Because I like that movie and I like a whatever 70-year reference.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
I appreciate that a lot.
Fair enough.
How did you feel about the placement of the big stunt, the airplane, in the first 5-10 minutes?
Thought it was great. Big fan. Yeah. Also, that stunt's bananas. I know I'm not saying anything that hasn't already been said, but one, they did a really good job of executing it. And
how so?
I don't know. It felt great. Like the idea of attaching the camera to the airplane, like I can't imagine how else you would have shot it practically, but just attaching the camera to the airplane and attaching crews to the airplane and just shooting it and being able to hold on a shot for a bit. I thought it was really great. I really enjoyed it. I thought I liked that sequence a lot. I thought it was a really great opening. I loved him exiting the plane, going right his little look and shrug that he gives, it's so fucking good. But yeah, no, I really enjoyed that sequence in general, and I thought the stunt was great, and I'm all for stunts in general.
Okay. Yeah. I didn't know if we were going to get I just kept waiting for the shot from the ground while the plane was taking off to kind of give you, look, he really is off the ground now, but they kind of just let it sink in, you know, it just kind of kept getting higher and higher, and it was like, no, that's why things are this small. This is happening.
Yeah, it's so cool. And I like how it's right at the beginning as well, because I will say that was very surprising, because that's such a big part of the marketing campaign. And so I was thinking about the marketing campaign of the first movie, where the big money shot is Tom Cruise jumping off the helicopter and landing on the train while the helicopter explodes behind him, which is the last moment of action in that movie. Yeah. So I thought it was a really nice counterpoint to that, basically, because it's still the most impressive moment in the movie that's in, and it's in the trailer, but at least we get it out of the way before there's any semblance of a plot, you know?
Yeah, the package is on the plane. What? No, no package. What? No one knows.
Yeah, exactly.
Just fucking do it. Just do it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I guess the danger of kind of holding on to that is everyone knows now, right?
Yeah, exactly. They're like expecting it.
Yeah, and so to get it out of the way, I like that.
Yeah.
Is this movie setting up a Mission Impossible / James Bond crossover? Because everything's about crossovers and universes now.
Absolutely not. James Bond does not cross over with anything.
MI6.
James Bond is like the last classy franchise left, so they gotta keep the class. Yeah.
That money whore James Bond. Yes. Is the class.
Yeah, I know, right?
But that does lead me to a question I did want to ask you. How is the Mission Impossible franchise meaningly different from, let's say, the Bond franchise, the Bourne franchise, and the Fast and Furious franchise, which I think are just the biggest think of? I know Fast and Furious is a stretch, but as heisty, action-y, globe-trotting action franchises, I don't think the stretch is as silly as it seems.
No. I'm going to get the Bourne movies out of the way. The Bourne movies are way better than any of the other ones you've said. The Bourne movies are are much more thoughtful, interesting movies. They're executed better and are just more enjoyable to watch. They're just tighter. Everything about them is better. Moving on. Bond, actually, well, Mission Impossible, I assume, was the first kernel of the idea of the Mission Impossible series, I believe, would probably start with somewhere in the 1990s, which is when people cared about James Bond the least. It's like Tom Cruise in 2006, you know, it's the James Bond is at a down period. We're coming off the Timothy Daltons, and Tom Cruise probably is like, hey, nobody, like, people hate James Bond, but people would still love a good James Bond. Why don't I make that good James Bond?
How can I have my own James Bond?
That's what I think it is. I really think that's where it starts. And so he wants this to be this classy franchise. And the first Mission Impossible movie is a very serious film. And that's something
that's really good.
It's very good. Absolutely. And Brian De Palma is an incredible stylist and knocks it out of the park in that movie. But yeah, he just wants to make this really like classy sort of franchise. And that's what they set out to do with Mission Impossible 1, right? And then that I think GoldenEye comes out that year or maybe two after. I'm going to look it up, right? Oh, GoldenEye is 1995. So it's probably the year before Mission Impossible. So Mission Impossible would have been in production.
In the works.
Yeah, exactly. And I do think Tom Cruise creates it as a counterpoint to the James Bond movies. And when you keep in mind the fact that GoldenEye is, debatably the only good Bond movie from after the 70s until Casino Royale, I think he was onto something, you know? Like, we still liked Bond movies and people still showed up for Bond movies, but we were kind of tired of the way of what they had morphed into. And so Tom Cruise kind of reset it. And yes, I think these Mission Impossible series doesn't exist without the Bond movies, but they were made specifically because the Bond movies were disappointing at that time. Yeah.
And I think it's interesting to point out that Bonds and Mission Impossibles have been coming out in the same year for a while now. Yeah. Which I kind of didn't even realize until I looked at the dates recently.
Yeah. Well, and Quantum of Solace comes out in between 3 and 4 of Mission Impossible, because there's like a 5 or 6 year break.
Yeah, there's a big window there. Yeah.
And just to talk about the Fast and Furious franchise just quickly. Yes, they're big action movies that feature a cast of humans. So...
That's all they get.
Okay. Well, there's globetrotting involved, but I feel like and honestly, like, really great action sequences in both. I think my description here has been colored by the fact that I didn't like Furious 7 very much, but I think they do definitely have something in common, and it's humans doing crazy shit. You know?
Yeah. Well, and I mean, just to talk about the Bond one, which I think is let's say more politically influenced than the Fast and Furious series. Yeah. I kind of mentioned earlier how Skyfall, all of the Bournes, and the most recent Mission Impossibles are all kind of reworking the same plot lately.
Yeah.
Where do you think that... Well, first of all, I think I just want to mention in this one, it's interesting that the way they deal with government agencies. I mean, we start off in this place where Brant and Hunley, Jeremy Renner and Alec Baldwin.
The Jack Donaghy. The Jack Donaghy moment when he talks about the Kremlin made me so happy. And Alec Baldwin does this every once in a while where he'll just find a Jack Donaghy moment in a movie that he's in where he's not playing Jack Donaghy, and it will just never cease to just make me laugh so hard.
Oh, and now I'm waiting for them, so when they happen, they're even better.
It's so good.
But anyway, so we're kind of, I mean, we like the IMF. We like our protagonists, so we're kind of placed in a spot to not like the CIA, not like Hunley / Baldwin / Donaghy. Mm-hmm. And we kind of get this idea throughout the movie that, you know, initially we kind of get government agencies are probably bad. You know, the CIA thing just wants to stop the IMF, who is doing real, real proper good work for the world, even if it's not recognized as such.
Yeah.
And then we later learn that the syndicate seems to be a government project. You know, we learn that it was a proposed British plan that our prime minister, who we also are kind of told to like through a certain, you know, bit of cinematic coding, you know, that we like him. But it was this other government agent who kind of let the syndicate project go on ahead, even though it was told to be stopped.
Yeah.
And it seems like we're getting this idea that government's good. It's just that there can still be, you know, pardon the pun, rogues within the government. That overall these government bodies are good and for the best, but people, just like they can do with terrorist group, like just like you can do with the terrorist group, one person, you know, can start them and make them turn them bad, things like that.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's like what you're saying, the it's not like the syndicate is that far away from IMF. They're both offshoots of big intelligence organizations. It's just they operate in different ways. They've chosen different sides of a coin. Yeah.
Well, I feel like they operate in the same way. They just have different goals.
Yeah.
Like, That's the big odd connection between the rogue nation syndicate and the IMF is that there's these things that operate with no oversight, so we can do things quickly to achieve our goals. However, the goals of the IMF are a lot different than the goals of the syndicate.
Yeah.
So it's just, I don't know, that's an interesting one for me. And then when we kind of put that up against the Bond ones, that's still something we see there. It's not so subversive that government is bad. It's kind of this fake subversive where the government's bad, but because it's a good system turned bad by bad people. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, I think you, tying back into what you've said about all of these franchises kind of being the same thing, I think Spectre is going to be pretty close to Rogue Nation plot wise, as far as these people operating initially within the government and kind of branching out from there. But yes, I agree entirely, and I see exactly the point you're making.
Yeah, and I mean, just to further it one other bit before I'm going to go back to the Bond thing, but especially with the syndicate, especially with Rogue Nation, more so. I mean, I think what I described there describes a lot of, you know, as I said, things in the that's huge in the Bourne. That is the Bourne franchise.
Yeah.
What I just described.
Yeah,
you know, and we see it in the recent Bonds, and we see it in the last, I'd say the two most recent Mission Impossible movies. That's, you know, a loose synopsis of the last two movies. But especially with Rogue Nation, what was interesting is how they tied in all these, you know, natural disasters or car accidents. Do you remember the scene where, you know, they're going through all the newspapers and saying, like, they're tying all these things into the syndicate?
Yeah, and the Malaysia Airlines is referenced a little bit.
Exactly. There's this kind of the same thing where there are these bad things, but there are these bad things in the world. There is some order to it.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a comforting feeling for people. And it's really interesting when they get spelled out like that in movies. It's planes don't just fall out of the sky. These natural disasters don't just happen. There is this comforting feeling that, like, it happens because bad people do it. And that maybe there's a chance that someday we're going to get rid of all of the bad people, and then these bad things will start happening. Mm-hmm. And there's that element in all conspiracy theories that bad things don't just happen. Bad people make bad things happen.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it hasn't really been that spelled out until this movie. And I thought that was a very interesting one to really see them connect the dots between these things in a real way like that.
Yeah.
But yes, to go back to the Bond thing, I mean, we've compared the two series a few times already. How does Mission Impossible get on without Tom Cruise? Does the franchise remain? I mean, this was the first Mission Impossible where everyone on his IMF team has already been on his IMF team in another movie, right? Like, you know, Ilsa's kind of on the fringe.
Is Luther in Mission Impossible too? I can't remember.
I don't know, but what I'm saying is he's been in one before. Benji's been in one before. Okay. Everyone's been in one, not necessarily the one immediate, but...
Yes, sorry, I'm an idiot.
Yeah, these are all established allies of his.
Yeah.
Do we keep going without Cruise? I mean, we have a next movie already in production that's been announced by the studio and everybody, all the major players involved, it's assumed. He's getting old. He's been the face of the franchise. As you said, he's got more control over these movies than Daniel Craig or Timothy Dalton ever had, you know, over their movies, you know?
Yeah.
How do we proceed from here? Because you'd assume we need some young people in here. I mean, I think we just got Baldwin for another one, which is fun.
Yeah. But
he's not the injection of youth that a franchise needs. Renner's around, but he seems to be working behind a desk for most of it. And again, isn't that young. Where do we go from here?
I don't know. I don't know. But if there's one thing I've learned, it's don't doubt Tommy. And he's a 53-year-old man that looks younger than me, and I'm 29. So I don't know. I don't know how they continue it on after he turns, I guess, 75 and eventually has to stop doing these things. Like, I feel like if he could do all this shit at 53, he's good till 60, you know? Barring some sort of, like, back injury or something that really slows him down. I don't know. Just... Don't count out Tom. Don't count out Ethan, you know?
Oh, and I don't mean for a while.
Yeah.
Let's say 4 more movies over 10 years would not shock me. I think what's really interesting is in the first movie, they really alienated a lot of their fans of the TV show by making Jim Phelps the bad guy.
Yeah.
How interesting would it be to see Ethan go bad by the end of, like, if that was his last one, to really pass the torch by going bad? But
that would be amazing.
Cruise wouldn't allow that.
No, Cruise would never do that.
Why not?
Because he wants.
Wouldn't it be the best, though?
It would, of course, it would be the best. But he just wants to be liked. Like, I think that's something that has always been a constant throughout his career, is that. He wants to be seen as a good guy. He wants to be seen as a hero in some capacity. And when he's not being seen as that type of person, he wants it to further the perception of Tom Cruise actor. You know, when he goes to do Eyes Wide Shut, he wants to be seen as somebody that can be Kubrick's Clay, you know, and for a year.
Magnolia.
Yeah, exactly. The same thing, which is playing off of his image, but and just giving his image over to somebody, an up-and-coming auteur that everybody seems to believe is going to be really great. And everybody was right. And just sort of like submitting to these types of things in order to further his public image. And you can see that in the 80s too. You mentioned Rain Man. He wanted to be able to stand next to Dustin Hoffman in a movie, just like he wanted to be able to be in a movie directed by Martin Scorsese and next to Paul Newman in The Color of Money. You know, he wants to be seen as this type of like, high point in Hollywood in every way, and I feel like in these types of movies that way is him being the hero.
But wouldn't it be cool if he went into like what he went through in the mid-2000s but times 10, like a super negative PR tailspin?
Yeah.
And then, you know, kind of does the, you know, you want a villain kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Like fully just goes Scarface and says he's the villain, and then that's how it ends. I don't know.
Look, I would love all of these things that you're describing. I would love to see them. You know, I would pay $50 for the ticket right now, but like they're just not going to happen.
All right. Well, here's to wishful thinking then.
I do have one quick question for you.
Oh, sure.
What happens if Tom Cruise speaks out against Scientology, like, tomorrow? Like, what if he is willing to give, like, a tell-all interview about his feelings about Scientology and say they're negative now? Like, say he is willing to be Paul Haggis and going clear. How does that change the way the public views Tom Cruise?
They like him way more, and his next movie makes a bunch of money.
And how does it affect his legacy?
I think it makes it so much better. I think he suddenly looks like a victim mm-hmm. and someone who saw the light. Like, I think we look at him the same way we look at Spanky and everybody else is going clear. You know what yeah. I mean? Someone who got it even worse. Someone who was stuck in it for a long time. Someone who really made it make a lot of very big decisions for him, because he has big decisions to make because he's so famous and rich.
Yeah.
I think it's the most interesting chapter in an already interesting biography of Tom Cruise's life. Yeah. It seems obvious. I think it would be great for him.
Yeah. Well, yeah, exactly. Like, because I was thinking about it, it would immediately become the most interesting thing he's ever done, right?
Yeah, that's what I mean. It's the most interesting chapter in an already yeah. interesting book. Like, yeah. it's so cool.
Yeah. Well, we'll see what happens tomorrow morning.
Here's to Tom Cruise denouncing Scientology.
So thank you for listening to MacGuffin Man, and be sure to check back next week.
Thanks for listening to The MacGuffin Men. Be sure to check out themacguffinmen.com for supplementary links, articles, and more. Thanks for listening.